Well, I said this morning then that we would be in Luke's Gospel this evening. We've normally been in this Gospel on our Sunday mornings, but for the reasons that I explained this morning, we're in Luke's Gospel this evening instead. And we're in this passage then that I read earlier on, Luke chapter 20, verses 1 to 19. In chapter 2 of this Gospel, Luke describes to us a fascinating little scene. Jesus, as a 12-year-old boy, at the Jerusalem temple, captivating the religious leaders there with his wisdom and insight, while his parents, Joseph and Mary, thinking that they've lost Jesus, are desperately trying to get hold of him. And in the last little bit of chapter 19, and here now in chapter 20, I think that there are echoes of that earlier scene. Except here, it's the adult Jesus at the Jerusalem temple. And here, it's the ordinary people, it's lay people, whom he is captivating with his wisdom and insights. And here, it's the religious leaders who are desperately trying to get hold of him. And of course, the really crucial difference is that unlike Mary and Joseph all those years earlier, these religious leaders are not trying to get hold of him out of a concern for his safety and well-being. They are trying to get hold of him out of a desire to kill him and to be done with him forever. And so against that backdrop, with those intriguing echoes of an earlier passage, I want us to notice three specific things in this section. First of all, a question. That's the first thing, a question. This is in verses 1 and 2. And the question to which I'm referring then is this question which the religious leaders asked Jesus about his authority. By what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority? It's almost certainly the recent temple eviction which they have most in mind here. Jesus' eviction of those animal sellers from the temple, there in chapter 19, verse 45. And they're asking him here then, who gave you permission to do that? You're not a priest. You're not a member of the Sanhedrin. You're not a part of the temple staff. You're not even affiliated with any sect or any prominent rabbi. You're this visitor from Galilee on your very first day in the city. Who gave you a mandate to just march into the temple and disrupt this system which has been operating there from before you were even born? That is what these religious leaders are asking. And it's in that kind of tone that they're asking it. This isn't a neutral question. This isn't a curious question. They aren't genuinely wondering which senior Jerusalem figure had given Jesus the go-ahead to do this. They know very well that nobody had given Jesus the go-ahead to do this. They are the senior Jerusalem figures, and he certainly hadn't consulted them. So they're not so much asking a question here as making an accusation. They're implying that Jesus is a troublemaker, that Jesus is a hooligan, that Jesus is a disrespectful menace, bringing all this chaos and all this unpleasantness into their sacred temple. And I think that it's worth us pausing for a moment and reflecting on that accusation then that these religious leaders are implicitly bringing against Jesus here. Because on the face of things, it has a certain force to it. Jesus had undeniably, in his actions there at the end of chapter 19, brought a great deal of chaos and unpleasantness into the temple. That temple eviction was an ugly event. And yes, to be sure, we know why he did it. We saw last week that it was the hypocrisy of these people, hiding their corrupt lifestyles behind a veneer of pious-looking temple activity. It was that which had prompted Jesus to do what he did here. We know why he did it, but even so, you and I would never dream of reacting in the way that he reacted there, would we? You and I would never dream of marching into some liberal Anglican cathedral and physically driving out the clergy because they don't really adhere to biblical truth. Quite apart from our fear of the consequences of such action, we would feel constrained by the New Testament itself. Paul's injunction, live at peace with everyone. Peter's injunction, show proper respect to everyone. We would feel it was a totally inappropriate way to proceed. And the point I'm getting at here then is this, that these religious leaders here are highlighting a real issue. They're highlighting the fact that unless Jesus has some special outside authority, unless Jesus has some divine, supernatural, heavenly authority, unless Jesus is a person of such intrinsic grandeur that he stands above the entire edifice of Jewish religion, then this temple eviction at the end of chapter 19 is a highly embarrassing incident, a blot on the gospel records, a blip, a real blip in the career of Jesus Christ. In other words, if you were to come to me this evening and say to me, look, I believe that Jesus was a good man. He taught us to forgive our enemies. He told the parable of the Good Samaritan. He embraced the outcasts on the fringes of society. I believe Jesus was a really good man, but I don't believe he was the Son of God. I don't believe that he was the Lord in any kind of objective, categorical sense. If you were to say that to me this evening, then I might say many things in response, but I might say to you, well, what about this temple eviction there in chapter 19? Was that good? Was that commendable? Would you encourage your children to behave in that kind of way? That dubious little incident is only salvageable if Jesus wasn't just a good man. If, in fact, he was the Son of God himself, the Lord himself, who does have the right to chuck hypocrites out of the temple. And I'm saying then that the temple eviction forces us to make a choice. It forces us to abandon any nonsense about Jesus being just a good man. It forces us to make a choice. Either Jesus was a bad, or at least a very inconsistent man, whose finest moments are utterly tarnished by the fact that he acted like such a hooligan on this occasion. Or Jesus was the Son of God, the Lord himself, who was acting perfectly within his rights, perfectly within his prerogatives here, chucking these people out of his own temple, his Father's house there in Jerusalem. You can't consistently, you can't tenably go down that route. He was just a good man. There are too many incidents like this one which expose that as ridiculous. Either he was bad or he was the Son of God to whom you must surrender the whole of your life, whom you must worship, whom you must follow as your master and your Lord. So that's the first thing that we have in this passage. We have a question. Secondly, this evening, A response. This is verses 3 to 12. And at first sight, then, Jesus' response to these religious leaders' question seems somewhat evasive, doesn't it? Why doesn't he just say to them, look, if it's authority that you're concerned about, then let me tell you, I have authority coming out of my ears. I have more authority than you guys have ever dreamed of. I have divine, supernatural, heavenly authority. I'm the Son of God. I'm the Lord himself. Why doesn't Jesus just say that? Why instead does he suddenly bring John the Baptist into the equation? Well, I think the answer is that by this stage in Jesus' public ministry, he's made more than enough claims about his own authority. And he knows very well that another one here on this occasion isn't going to make a great deal of difference. And so he wants to do something else here. He wants to demonstrate that their failure to recognize his authority isn't just a one-off, unfortunate error of judgment on their part, but rather it reflects a very ingrained and deeply rooted rebelliousness toward God himself. And he demonstrates this then by taking them back to Israel's most recent prophet. Who was Israel's most recent prophet? John the Baptist, of course. And how then had these religious leaders received John the Baptist? Had they received him as a heaven-sent messenger of God? Had they listened to him? Had they sat at his feet and eagerly drunk in everything that he had to say? No, not at all. They had considered him a self-appointed loony out there in the desert. That's very clear in that little confab that they have in verses 5 and 6, where they freely admit to each other that they hadn't believed, verse 5, they hadn't believed John. And then in verse 6, that they would publicly affirm that John is just a self-appointed loony if it wasn't for their fear that the crowd might stone them if they did. When I began at a theological college in Edinburgh, the first day of lectures was a Tuesday. And on the Monday evening, there was a formal opening service for the new academic year. And after the service, there were refreshments, and during those refreshments, I found myself chatting to this fellow, and he introduced himself to me, I introduced myself to him, and during the conversation, I kind of got the impression that he knew a little bit about me, even though we'd never met before, but I didn't think too much of it. And then as the conversation was winding up, he said to me, "Well, I'll see you tomorrow then." And so I, thinking that he must be some cleaner or some janitor or some office administrator who was expecting to bump into me around the college building, I said, "Oh, so you work here then?" To which he replied, "Yes, I teach church history." It was a very mortifying experience. I felt ever so bad every time I sat in one of his lectures after that. And it was careless of me. I should have been sufficiently familiar with the college prospectus to have realised as soon as he introduced himself to me who this man was. But imagine that that evening I had subsequently gone up to the New Testament professor and said, "Hello there, sir, are you the chap that cleans the windows around here?" And I then gone up to the Old Testament professor and said, "Hello, you must be the guy who answers the phones at reception there." And I then gone up to the systematic theology professor and said, "So are you the bloke who makes the coffee around here then?" Then that would have suggested more than mere carelessness, wouldn't it? That would have suggested a deliberate and sinister opposition to that whole educational establishment. And that's kind of what Jesus is getting at here. He's saying to these religious leaders, "Look, your attitude to me, it's part of something bigger. It fits into a whole pattern of behaviour. It's of a piece with your attitude to John the Baptist." And then, in fact, as he goes on and as he moves into this parable in verse 9, he goes further back than John the Baptist. Because in this parable then, the vineyard represents Israel. And these servants who are sent by the owner to the vineyard represent the whole succession of Old Testament prophets. And how then did the Jews, they're the tenants in the vineyard, how did the Jews receive all these prophets? Well, they received them all in the same way, didn't they? They beat them. They abused them. They treated them shamefully. They sended them away empty-handed. They wounded them. They threw them out. That is how they received them. And Jesus then is saying to these religious leaders, "Look, your attitude toward me is of a piece with your and your forefathers' attitude toward all the Old Testament prophets, from Moses right up to John the Baptist. Your attitude toward me, it fits into that whole pattern. It's part of that whole bigger picture. It's not mere carelessness. It's It's not that you haven't sufficiently read up on me. It's rather a deliberate and sinister opposition to the whole plan of God. It's rather a deeply ingrained and deep-rooted rebelliousness toward God himself. That's what it's about. This isn't a one-off unfortunate error of judgment. This is a deep-rooted rebelliousness toward God himself. And as we this evening live amongst men and women and boys and girls who also reject the authority of Jesus Christ, those people, of course, are not first century Jewish religious leaders. The people around us are 21st century Gentile pagans. And in many ways, therefore, they're very different. But you know, the underlying principle is exactly the same. That their rejection of the authority of Jesus Christ, their rejection of Jesus as the Son of God and Lord of all, reflects a very ingrained and deep-rooted rebelliousness toward God himself. And it's important we remember that, because I think we can sometimes have this idea that if only we find the right evangelistic formula, if only we find the right technique, if only we find the right apologetic argument, if only we find the right celebrity testimony, then we'll see hundreds of people being converted and bowing at the feet of Jesus Christ. And it's not so. It's as if we think that people are just a short way away from bowing before Jesus Christ and accepting his authority. As if they just need a little nudge in the right direction. They just need a bit of cajoling. And then they will be his followers. It's not so. People around us are a million miles away from accepting the authority of Jesus Christ. Just as these people were here. They have this deeply ingrained rebelliousness toward God. And I'm not saying for one moment that we shouldn't use evangelistic techniques and strategies and all the rest of it. Of course we must. But what I'm saying is that we must do so conscious that it is only a mighty, irresistible miracle of Almighty God that will make a single one of them a follower and worshipper of Jesus Christ. That's what Jesus is doing here. He's demonstrating that the problem with these Jewish religious leaders is far deeper than just that they haven't quite got it about his identity. No, they're not going to get it unless God does something mighty in their hearts, because it's there's something underlying here. There's a deeper problem here, and it's the same with people around us. And that's why we must accompany all our evangelism with prayer, because evangelism in itself is useless. It's God whose power we rely upon to turn those who have this deep-rooted rebelliousness toward God from that to worshipping Jesus Christ. We must lean upon him as we go out with the gospel. So we've seen a question, we've seen a response. Thirdly and finally, a prediction. A prediction. And this then is the second half of the parable, verses 13 onwards. Because, as I said, then in the first half of the parable, Jesus has been looking backwards. He's been reflecting on this whole succession of Old Testament prophets, all of whom have been treated and received in the same way by the Jews. But in verse 13, he comes to the present, and then in verse 14 and onwards to the future. And really, then, he predicts two things here. First of all, there's a prediction about his own death. This is verses 13 and 14. Then the owner of the vineyard said, "What shall I do? I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him." So this is God then, having sent all these prophets, now sending his son, who of course is Jesus. And then verse 14, "But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. This is the heir, they said, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him." Jesus here is first of all predicting his own death. Now there's nothing particularly radical about that. As those who have been studying Luke's gospel now for some time, we have seen he's already predicted his death. He's predicted it several times, and most recently and most explicitly in chapter 18, verses 31 to 33. But perhaps the distinctive feature of this particular prediction of his own death is the emphasis, I think that's an appropriate word, certainly strong hint on the cost to the Father of Jesus' death. Because you look at that language in verse 13, God saying, "What shall I do? I will send my Son, whom I love." And of course, Jesus is teaching the Jews here, and the Jews' minds would have immediately gone back to Genesis 22, the account of Abraham and Isaac. Remember God's command to Abraham, "Take your son, your only son, whom you love. Take him to the top of Mount Moriah and sacrifice him there." And of course, when we read that account of Abraham and Isaac, our focus isn't upon the terrible ordeal that Isaac's going through here. Our focus is upon the Abraham's ordeal as the father, isn't it? They're having to take that long walk over several days up that mountain with his son, his only son, whom he loves, knowing that at the top he's going to have to take a knife out and plunge it into the heart of that boy whom he loves so dearly. It's Abraham's plight that really evokes the tears when we read that narrative, isn't it? And I think that here then, we're supposed to feel somewhat similar about God the Father. I think too often when it comes then to God sacrificing his son, it's the other way around. We focus exclusively on Jesus' ordeal, on his sufferings at the cross. And of course, his sufferings were awful, but the Father, like Abraham, also suffered at the cross, didn't he? He was sacrificing his son, the son whom he loved. It was his dearest, his nearest, the apple of his eye, his precious one, whom he was sacrificing at that cross. It was a terrible ordeal, not just for the son, but for the father as well. How deep the father's love for us, how great beyond all measure, that he should give his only son to make a wretch his treasure. I think it's something we need to reflect on much more than we do, what the Father went through on that Good Friday at Calvary, standing on the sidelines, watching his own dear son suffer like that. So not just watching his son suffer, but being the one actually imposing the suffering. What a broken heart he must have nursed that terrible day at Golgotha. So there's a prediction of his own death. But then secondly, a prediction of the Jews' judgment. Because then he continues, doesn't he? "What will the owner of the vineyard do to them?" Verse 15. "He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others." And I think then that the killing of the tenants is a reference to the judgment that was going to fall at AD 70. We talked about this last week because Jesus has been predicting it, hasn't he, in chapter 19. And I think that's what's been referred to here. When he talks about the tenants being killed, he's talking about the terrible devastation that was going to come to Jerusalem, to the city that had crucified the Son of God 40 years later in AD 70. And then the giving of the vineyard to others part of the judgment, I think that's predicting then the explosion of the gospel among the Gentile world. The fact that the gospel was going to move away from the Jews. The Jews were going to be left by God. And hundreds and then thousands and then eventually millions of Gentiles were going to come into the people of God. And it's that in particular that's being referred to, of course, in the quote from Psalm 118, there in verse 17, "The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone." So the stone then that the builders rejected is Jesus, and the builders are the Jews. They've rejected Jesus. But despite their rejection, Jesus is still going to become the cornerstone of a great building, but not a Jewish building initially, but a Gentile building as Gentiles come into the people of God. And it seems to me that two things, just as we close, two things are worth particularly noting in this connection. First of all, it's notice that the Gentiles here are coming into the vineyard, the same vineyard, the vineyard that's been in view in the parable all along. The judgment here isn't that God is going to destroy the vineyard and create a new vineyard. The judgment is that he's going to expel the present tenants of the vineyard and bring in new ones. And that's vitally important, I think. And it's the truth then that was brought out in that passage in Romans 11, isn't it? Where Paul there talks in similar botanical imagery, not quite the same. He's talking about an olive tree rather than a vineyard, but it's similar imagery. And there it's the idea then of the original branches being severed, being cut off. That is the Jewish branches. And these new branches being grafted in, that is the Gentiles. But the point again is it's the same tree. God didn't chop down the first tree and plant a new one. There's one tree throughout. And the Gentiles then are brought into that tree. And you might say, well, are we splitting hairs here? Does this really matter? Well, it does matter for lots of reasons, I think. But it has one very significant implication, which is this. It contains within it a note of hope for the Jews, doesn't it? Because it's their vineyard. It's their olive branch. The Jews remain the original, rightful people of God, if you like. Paul says, doesn't he, in Romans, the gospel is to the Jews first and then the Gentiles. The Jews are still the proper and rightful members of the people of God. The Gentiles are there as those who have been grafted in from outside. And as Paul says then in Romans 11, if the Gentiles have come into the people of God, though outsiders, how much more easily will God bring the Jews back in as those who are the natural branches? And so there's a note of hope there, I think, that encourages us to pray for the Jews, encourages us to pray that they will, in great numbers, respond to Messiah Jesus. You see, we look at them and their spiritual state today, and they're so far away, we might think, well, there's no point praying for them. If there's one people in the world there's no point praying for, it's the Jews. Their opposition is so stringent and entrenched. And Paul is saying, no, there's every reason to pray for the Jews to come to Jesus. They are the natural branches. It's their vineyard still. Pray then that they will come back into it. Pick up the magazine at the back, the Christian Witness to Israel magazine. Get interested in Jewish evangelism, because it's their olive branch, it's their vineyard. But then the other thing that's worth considering here is that everyone must beware judgment, not just the Jews. Because that's how Jesus kind of concludes, isn't it, in verse 18. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but he on whom it falls will be crushed. In other words, Jesus is saying that yes, there's going to be this specific judgment upon the Jews in AD 70 because they have rejected me. But look, don't just feel sorry for the Jews, or don't just gloat that they're the ones who were judged because they rejected me. Everyone who rejects me will ultimately be judged. If you like, AD 70 is a little foreshadowing. It's a little visual aid. It's a little illustration of what everybody who rejects me will one day receive. Indeed, I think there's probably a play on this language of stones here. Because, of course, what was the judgment in AD 70 going to look like? Well, in chapter 19, verse 44, it was going to be one stone not being left upon another. The stones of the Jerusalem walls and the Jerusalem buildings were going to be toppled. Stones were going to fall. And Jesus is saying that you might not be a Jew and you might not have been caught up in the events of AD 70, but if you reject Jesus, one day stones will fall on you. I will fall on you. I, the stone himself, will fall on you with devastating ferocity. And so I'm saying that we shouldn't just look back at AD 70 as this interesting historical event. We should look back on it as a warning to all of us. It was a miniature version of what will happen to all who reject Jesus. Those Jews in Jerusalem rejected Jesus. They crucified him. They put him on a cross. And so stones fell on them in AD 70. And that was a little miniature of what will ultimately happen to all who reject Jesus. As the stone himself, Jesus, will come crashing down on all who have not acknowledged him and bowed the knee to him. And so it challenges us tonight. Have we responded to Jesus Christ? Read the history books about AD 70. Read Josephus. Read some other historical account of that event. And it was a terrible, terrible happening there in Jerusalem. But there's something worse coming. And on the same basis, rejection of Jesus Christ. We must not risk the stone falling on us on that day. We must make sure that we are his and have given our lives to him. May God help us all to do so. Amen. Let's close with 86, doxology. Now to him whose power is able to protect our stumbling feet.